Hello and welcome to Journeys of Maxa podcast. Today I'm here with Clarissa De La Garza, who is a clarinetist, pianist, and composer. She's also on faculty here at Maxa in piano and clarinet. We're delighted to have you today, Clarissa. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I was excited to talk to you because you have, basically when I started to get exposed to your compositions, it's like this whole new world opened up. I know you as a pianist, I know you as a clarinet performer. And I'm excited later to get into that more into your compositions. But first I want to talk about how your journey started, how you got into music, how you got into clarinet and piano. So take us back in time. And how did this journey begin for you?
So both of my parents are musicians. Actually, I come from a whole family of musicians. My dad's a drummer and a singer. My mom is a pianist and a singer. So I kind of grew up with music around the house all the time.
Fantastic.
My grandparents were musicians. My grandmother was a bass clarinetist. My grandfather was a violinist and a clarinetist. So just music around the house all the time. When I was really young, I had more of an interest in art, actually. I wasn't terribly interested in taking lessons as a kid, but when I homeschooled, actually, around middle school, early high school, I started taking clarinet lessons with the local professor at the university where I'm from. And he really helped me kind of open up a lot more as a musician and inspired me a lot. And that's where my journey mostly started. I participated in the youth symphony in my city and we played lots of concerts and things. And he actually, the professor invited me to play with his clarinet choir at the university. So I was 13 when I started playing with them as just a guest performer, I guess. And that's kind of where I started from there.
So what was that like as a 13-year-old? I guess you would have been pretty early on your path there, right? And then suddenly you're in this clarinet choir. What did that feel like?
It was a lot of fun, honestly. I felt very welcomed by the students there. Also, the repertoire was within my ability, so I was able to keep up. It was challenging for sure, but it was a nice little push for me, definitely.
You know, it's interesting talking with people who come from musical families, and this is quite an extensive musical family, you know, or any family, I guess, where there's an inclination for something, be it art or music. In fact, my family was art was the and music, I guess. But I wonder sometimes. Do you think that did your initial interest in art was that? Was it any part of that that you were trying to kind of have a separate voice or something different, or was it? Do you know what I mean? I'm just curious about that.
That's a super interesting question. I don't think it was on purpose. I just always liked drawing and making things and crafting things and building things. I've always been that. I was really happy that music became a part of it later on. And eventually, when I was in high school, I was kind of at a crossroads with what I wanted to do. Going forward, because I had a very strong interest in architecture. I actually wanted to be an architect for many years. I had a big interest in that and design, graphic design. I thought maybe I would get into advertising and things like that, but music just kind of never left me, and I decided that that's what I wanted to do instead.
So you had a very strong pull. I mean, those are a really amazing creative things that I see some of that architecture in your compositions. I want to get into that a little bit later, as I said, but it's interesting as you talk about this, the way I think that we often will combine, right, all these different interests and different ways throughout our careers and our lives. And I can say, like I said, I can kind of see that. But anyway, so when you decided that you wanted to do music, like, was there a particular, like an event, or was it a kind of a gradual realization? Because at some point you had to say, like, I'm going to go to college for this. You know, I mean, there was a point where you had to, like, make it kind of real. You know, do you recall that?
Yeah, so music, I mean, was largely an outlet for me. It was more of a hobby, but it was something that I very, very much enjoyed. My high school band experience was a little bit rough, you know. The push was to win and to be the best. And there was a lot of anger, I guess, the teachers there. But when I went to my private lessons with my clarinet professor, it was just a totally different world. And he was very calm and kind and caring. And he would serve me hot tea. And it was just this very peaceful environment. And I realized that there had to be more to teaching than what I knew from the band. And I wanted to explore that side of things. And I wanted to share music with others in the way that my teacher did with me.
Right. You know, that's a beautiful story. Can we have the teacher's name that helped you so much?
Yeah, Dr. Bill O'Neill. He's actually still teaching now.
Okay, great.
All these years later, he's at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley
in
Edinburgh.
That's wonderful. Okay, fantastic. Yeah.
Big inspiration for me, for
sure.
Well,
you know, and that's so important. You know, I mean, that I think that's one really where a lot of the magic, and you know, sometimes it's a coach for people who do, you know, things like athletics and whatever, but like the relationship can be so powerful with a private teacher and can really be kind of a outside support that can really transform your life. And I think that's what you're saying. And I kind of detect also, you sort of alluded to that became sort of an inspiration for yourself to share that with others, right? With your own students.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's really wonderful. How did you first meet Dr. O'Neill, is that right? So how did you first meet him?
Yeah. So the homeschooling group that I was a part of in eighth grade, one of the parents talked to my mom and she said, "Oh, my son's in this symphony."
Okay.
And where the symphony would meet was on campus. And back then it was called University of Texas Pan American before they went through that big change.
Yes.
And so on Sundays we would have our rehearsals there. Mm-hmm. And it so happened that Dr. O'Neill was around at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was recommended to my parents. And mm-hmm. that's how we met. And they reached out to him, and he agreed to take me on for lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was homeschooling, so I could just go.
Okay.
I think, if I remember correctly, clarinet choir rehearsal was Tuesday and Thursday mornings at 11 a.m.
Oh, I see.
Which I was able to do.
Yes, right.
And I don't remember, one of those days was when I would go in for my lesson an hour before. Mm-hmm. And so I would have my lesson with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then go to rehearsal,
mm-hmm.
go home and have lunch and continue with the rest of my school day at home.
Well, that sounds like a pretty wonderful way to get started.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, too, like those initial moments, like, okay, how did you find this teacher? How did they? Because a lot of times, like, these really masterful teachers like that are like, full, you know, and they're
right.
kind of permanently full,
uh-huh.
you know. And actually being homeschooled makes a massive difference. Then, you know, you can work and to get to be in the clarinet choir
right.
is really special. But it's interesting how we find those people, like how what led to that. So, you know, you went to the symphony rehearsal on Sundays. He was around. You probably saw him. Somebody said to your parents that this was a person who is really, really wonderful as a teacher. And then it kind of went from there. Am I capturing that?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Pretty much what happened, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk a little bit about then. So now it's time you're going to go to college, right? You're deciding what to do. And I think you stayed in down in the valley, right, for your bachelor's degree. Is that right?
I did, and I continued to study with Dr. O'Neill
officially
an undergraduate student. Okay. So that's what I had done there.
Did the relationship shift at all when you became a college student?
It stayed the same.
You still got the tea and everything?
Yeah.
Okay. Then
I think by the end of it, I studied with him for 10 years before I finally graduated. So from eighth all the way through.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's a significant. That's big.
Yeah.
That's big time.
So he's a more of a personal friend now, and we
right.
still keep in touch.
Yeah. Isn't that, it's really kind of amazing. I'm getting to experience that some with my own alumni. They become these fantastic, like, lifelong friends, you know, and it's really amazing to continue hearing about their journey, and sometimes I get to help them a little bit on that, and that's wonderful that he's doing that with you as
mm-hmm.
well. That's fantastic. So then you come to San Antonio, and you just finished your master's degree, which is a massive thing to do. And what led you to UTSA then for your master's?
Well, a couple of things. You know, I'm pretty tethered to this area right now,
right, of course.
For my work, but. You know, so UTSA was around and convenient,
right.
but I was also very drawn to the clarinet professor there,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Nicholas Counselor,
mm-hmm.
who I studied with.
Yes.
He just had a very impressive background. He looked younger, and
mm-hmm.
I thought that maybe he would offer a fresh perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. O'Neill was a little more traditional, old-fashioned.
Right. Okay.
And I felt that I needed a change, so
yes.
to speak. And the decision to go back ultimately came from I'm sure a lot of teachers probably feel that they may plateau in their performing because they
sure.
spend so much time in the
mm-hmm.
classroom, in
yeah.
the lesson room, and they're not playing as much as they
mm-hmm.
used to. And I didn't want that to happen to me. I
right.
knew that I wanted more. I wanted to continue to grow and improve. And so I sent him an email, and
mm-hmm.
he responded back within the day,
yeah.
offered a free lesson. I went in and studied with him, and I auditioned a week later.
Wow.
So it was...
Great.
It was really, really cool, and he definitely offered that fresh perspective that I needed. Uh-huh. So I feel that my education's a little more well-rounded now.
Yeah, that is important. I mean, you do have to be mindful of that. And a combination of stability and a foundation in the traditional approach is actually kind of the best place to start, I think. And then I think you hit it out of the park with that. Like then getting something with a more fresh perspective and the directions things may be going, that's very refreshing. And so just to touch on a little bit, so you, the relationship, how that got made. So you had, there was a proximity there, right? You're in the area. UTSA is an excellent school. So you reach out to him, you studied, looked at his background, right? Obviously something though happened in the lesson, because of course we've seen people have great backgrounds from great schools, and you go to the lesson and it's like, they're not really, there's not a connection made. So what did, do you recall, like, what made you feel like, okay, this is gonna work?
Yeah, so I went in for that lesson. It was mostly to hear me on my audition materials for the entrance audition, right? Mm-hmm. And I was playing Weber's Concerto in F, the third movement. And it's a fantastic movement. So awesome. Weber's known for his operatic writing.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, my clarinet performance, as I thought at the time, was clean and correct. Mm-hmm. And he showed me there's so much more than clean and correct.
I see.
He said, you know, you're playing so safe.
Ah.
Open up. Just sing. You know how to play. And I was like, I do know how to play. Do you mean I'm allowed to do that? And he said, you don't need my permission to do that. Sing, be an opera, opera performer. Yes. And I realized that I had needed more of that. I guess having that freedom to be more expressive and confident in what I knew I already had in me, that I kind of was playing inside the box a little bit. And he helped me play outside the box a little bit more. It was really cool.
So that's a very important lesson. So that's something that... So that lesson that you had, and also a lesson for everyone, is that like we I call that a musical experience. Mm-hmm. Even no matter how virtuosic you were, you came in, you know, very high level virtuosic player, and yet you still are seeking that musical experience, that connection to yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And he validated that and pushed you outside of your comfort zone, which is another thing that great teachers will do. Now, of course, the probably your band director was also trying to push everybody out of their comfort zone, but they were using a different kind of system that wasn't really working for you, right?
Right. Well, that experience was more of, you know, a student would struggle and they would just say, practice more. Mm. You're not practicing enough.
Okay.
But there was not much of the, how do you do that?
Yeah.
And Dr. O'Neill gave me that, and Dr. Counselor gave me that.
I typically call those when you are getting the how from someone, that is a teacher, that is a person telling you how to get to here, and when they just tell you to get there, that's a demander.
Right.
That's a demander. Now we need demanders. Demanders are very, very good, and they're usually best once you already know how, and they're later in your career, like when you just want people to kind of push you, and you can already figure out how, but they can be very dangerous early, and a lot of people give up and quit because the demander doesn't provide the how. Now, also demanders can be geniuses, and a lot of times performers will be demanders because they also demand of themselves. So I'm not trying to say demanders are bad. I'm just saying necessarily. It's just that people need to be mindful of the difference between a teacher and a demander. And if you're really fortunate, you have a person who can flip between demander and teacher depending on where you're at. At that time. So anyway, that was quite magical. Well, what was really also amazing is that you ended up winning the concerto competition and performing that piece with the orchestra, if I'm not mistaken.
I ended up playing Debussy's Premier Rhapsody.
That's what it was. Okay.
Much more challenging piece, if I have to say.
Okay. But that's amazing. That's what I mean. Mm-hmm. Talk about challenging your performance chops. I mean, play with a soloist with an orchestra and compete in order to get that right. And then I think you also did another, am I mistaken, did you have another orchestra solo performance?
In undergrad I did.
Okay. And what was that? Was that the Webern then?
That was another Weber piece, the concertino
by Weber. Okay, I'm getting stuck up on that. But anyway,
I played a lot of Weber. I like Weber.
Well, it's great music,
he's great.
Awesome. let's talk a little bit about your journey in composition. So when did that start for you?
That started when I was in high school. It was more of just an independent interest, mm-hmm. I asked my dad for Christmas, can I please have Finale?
Are you serious?
And he said, what is that? I said, I don't know. It's some software where you write music. And he said, okay. And he bought me Finale. And this was all the way back in like 2009 or 2000,
right.
something like
back
that. And I would just doodle and make little, little pieces. Mm-hmm. You know, for a time, they weren't really that significant, but that was how I started. Mm-hmm. That was that was my sketch pad. That was my new sketch pad, and I used to draw and doodle.
I see.
Now
okay.
I
yes.
was making music, and that was what I like to do, just make little short pieces for clarinet, little pieces for piano, and it just kind of evolved from there. And when I was an undergrad, I hit a huge, I guess, moment where I was like, I can study other things other than just clarinet.
And
I took composition lessons, I took piano lessons, I took conducting lessons, I did everything. I wanted to learn all the stuff.
Oh, so you just like bring it on.
I overloaded my hours and did like 20-hour semesters and did all these crazy things. And composition was in there. And that was where I was actually shown actual techniques and, you know, a little bit more refined methods of putting my stuff together.
Awesome. Well, that's amazing. You know, now, had any of the... in your family, have there been any composers in the family?
Not that, well, kind of. My mom's a songwriter, singer-songwriter. But as far as conventional composition, not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, that's amazing. Well, I was really excited to hear all the repertoire on your website, that it's so varied, and it's the selections you put on there show such a great range. And so I wanted to listen to some of those things and talk to you about a little bit.
Okay.
Like I said, I could hear the architecture. And of course, I'm just listening, you know, one time through. And but they're very engaging. And I think also, like one of the pieces is for early level clarinet. That's the Eventide, I think, the sonata. And I also thought the piano part is very accessible as well. It's and, you know, having accessible and also interesting pieces for, you know, people that are in high school. I'm not sure what the target group was for you necessarily, but, I mean, those are hard to find. You know, it's hard to find pieces that work really well for that level of student. It's a great piece. Also, your recent, well, we should actually just get into it a little bit. So what I thought we'd do is we'll listen to a little from your website, and then we'll just, you know, just talk a little bit about them. So I'm going to get this going here. And why don't you say, so the website is cdelagarzamusic.com, and you have scores for purchase on here, as well as the videos, and some of them have the music, and some of them are the performances themselves. So I think it might be interesting to hear... Oh, there's so many good ones. I mean, it's all really good.
We can start with the sonata if you'd like.
Let's do the sonata. Okay, so this is the Eventide sonata number one. Now, this sonata number one implies that you either have a sonata two, or you're going to. Like, do you have other ones in the works?
So there is an entire collection planned of beginner-friendly clarinet music that is made to, you know, inspire a little bit beyond what middle school students are typically exposed to. I noticed a discrepancy in the repertoire that's available to clarinet players at the early levels. You know, when we play piano music for beginners, there's so much out there.
There's
an entire world. And
even the
piano adventures, the Faber stuff, it's adventurous, fun, expressive music that's easily accessible. Clarinet doesn't really have that. They play, you know, their hot cross buns and jingle bells, and they have their band concerts, but they don't have the opportunity to perform solos in the way that pianists do. And usually the music that they just play is their band stuff.
Right.
In a large group, they don't get the opportunity to explore that more expressive side of their performance. And so this piece was born from that. I wanted to create thoughtful, expressive stuff that kids could play. That sounds mature.
I love that. You know, that's a good example of, again, your crossover between doing piano and clarinet as well. So because we are, you know, blessed with a vast repertoire at the different levels for piano. And I think if your only exposure, I mean, one of the downsides with piano is we often don't get to play in an ensemble.
Right.
But it's almost, then you have, you have almost like no exposure to solo playing, as you said, or duet playing. If not for pieces like this. So let's take a quick listen here. I'll just start at the beginning, and we're not going to do all of it, but let's just take a listen. So. To stop right there. So first of all, it's so pretty, and then also it's like, aha, we're going to work on some long tones here, mm-hmm. and holding that out, and we're going to be like, I'm imagining you, it's almost like an etude in a sense, like I'm imagining this. And now I don't know, I do not play clarinet.
Okay,
so I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm gonna make that very, very clear, but it seems like this would be you know, controlling that tone going down is an important thing to learn how to do, especially those long notes after you've done the shorter notes. I'm just imagining that would be hard. And it's done in a very pretty way. Am I capturing that goal?
Yeah, so it's right in that sweet spot of the left-hand upper joint notes that all the beginner players are constantly using in their first year.
This is something I know nothing about.
And all of the music for the beginner level is typically in the key of B-flat.
Okay.
And so this just uses those notes in the key of B-flat, but with a more adventurous twist on the accompaniment to make the harmonies more refreshing.
Right.
That way everything's in that B-flat major all the time.
Got it.
We got some suspensions and some atypical, you know, chord progressions and things like
Love it. Very pretty. And again, like I said, the piano part's very accessible, you know, and I think that, so let's go a little bit ahead. I want to see if we can get to the, now tell me if you want me to look at something else. I was thinking we might look at the second movement.
The second movement I actually wrote first.
Oh, did you?
I did. Oh, that's the first one I finished.
Okay,
And then the third, and then the first I did last.
Interesting. Okay. Let's take a listen to this one. Stop that. It's so pretty. What I think is amazing, again, is it's a very straightforward idea, right? It's alternating thirds, and you've got these cool bass notes shifting the harmonies there, and some really yummy chords underneath it, which would make that, we talked a little bit about a musical experience earlier, that the person playing this, you know, on the clarinet would probably be like, wow. You know, they're practicing it alone, and then they get the piano part in there, and it's like a real awakening, you know. I'm imagining that those thirds are also pedagogically, there's something for that, too.
Yeah, and the pitches that are used are also very well within the kinds of things that they learn in the first year.
Okay.
They start reading their B-flats, they start reading their G-sharps, they start reading their C-sharps down, but most of it is primarily in that left hand. So it's all very pedagogically sound for an early player.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I thought was particularly amazing. Of course, your other pieces that you have some massively virtuosic things, but when you have to kind of restrain yourself, you know, architecturally, right? In a way, it's like you're designing a building and they tell you the budget's like, you know, way different than what you might have had. Like, it's not like anything goes. It's like you have to be constrained. That's where you really see some resourcefulness, you know, and creativity there. So it's really, really, and it's beautiful. It's titled Midnight, and it has that, you know, haunting quality to it, which is just absolutely lovely. Let's jump to the last movement here. There we go. Is that, I'm getting there, and almost there. Okay. Why am I seeing that? Oh, there we go. Okay. Here we go. Thank you. So again, now I've learned something from you, which is that that area of the clarinet is that uses a lot of left hand, and that's something that they get exposed to a lot. This again seems to be emphasizing that area, right? And then of course the pianist has got more work in this one,
Yeah, a little
but
bit.
but that's okay, because actually even with the more work, it's arpeggios and it's things that you know everybody's supposed to be practicing, and it's but I also think that it's really cool that one of the nice things about a multi-movement piece is that you can definitely do one movement and it would be fine. But to get the experience of what it's like to do a multi-movement piece for a younger player is also, I think, kind of a profound thing to do for those that do more. Anything you want to mention about that otherwise?
I guess also a lot of kids, especially in more recent generations, are exposed to music or concert music through film and video game type stuff.
Yes, of course.
And so I tried to create a scenic picture. Mm-hmm. So the three movements are dusk and midnight and dawn.
Oh,
so
perfect.
So they can follow the visual element of sun going down, it's dark, and then the sun comes up at the end, just to help them kind of get into the, I guess, appropriate mindset or character.
Yeah, go beyond the page somewhat. Mm-hmm. Like go into some imagery.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's a little bit of note painting, I guess.
Yeah.
With the imagery, there's a lot of descending patterns in the sun going down, and then there's a lot of ascending patterns in the sun coming up.
Yes.
So it helps them kind of learn a little bit more about why music does the things that it does, and why it makes us feel a certain way, and how they can link with the more psychological aspects of that.
Right, and it also harkens back to your art in a way, like you're painting and notes now. As well as and having a visual element, which again is very powerful when you link together these different parts of ourself. If you were a chef, you'd be making a morning pastry of exciting pastry for the morning, I guess. But it was art instead. Let's jump to something quite different. Let's see here. This was one that I guess for my personally, because I'm a piano guy. Where is it? It was the one that was more atonal. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the
That's
name.
That's that one right there.
This in here. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. Oh, yes. Okay, I'm going to go. Yes. So interesting. So you have these fortissimo, like crazy chords, you know, in the piano part, and then the clarinet part is pianissimo.
Right.
So I thought that's because the other thing you're playing with here is like the sound lingering in the piano, and what happens, of course, in the piano the sound's decaying, and in the clarinet the sound is still alive. And what occurred to me is like, oh, I wonder if you're playing with that some. Is that what you were? I mean, I don't know. I sort of feel like I'm leading the witness here a little bit. But
no, that's
what
fine.
Was your, what, that, I just thought it was so interesting. As a
so
choice,
the way that the piece was constructed, it's actually both through composed and symmetrical in a way. The clarinet does A, B, C, B, A.
Okay.
And the piano just A, B, C, D, E.
Oh, interesting.
And the reason why it's called five spatial abstractions is because they're playing with intervallic functions. So the first is the clusters. Mm-hmm. Then the tritones, then the seconds, then the thirds, and then the fourths, fifths at the very end.
Okay.
So it goes from dissonance to consonance by the very end of the piece.
Yes, and I noticed that. I noticed the structure kind of revealing itself going through. It was helpful to be looking at the score actually, because I kept thinking, oh wow, I'm seeing all these interesting patterns, even with the time signatures too, like the 5/4s and the 5/8s or whatever. I don't know if that was on what it just sort of came out, that the structure there and definitely the consonant part was quite amazing. So that's really interesting. I kind of wish we had more. This is something I think you could spend an hour talking about the construction of it. And I know we're just taking little snippets of things, but was there anything else about this that you want to mention?
Not particularly. This one is a lot more carefully crafted than some of the others. It's not as personally inspired, but it was very academic.
Okay, yeah, so
type
you're
of
like,
a piece.
You're like, what is it? Your challenge, the limitation there, in a sense, is like I'm going to be creating patterns, as opposed to the other pedagogical piece. It was like I'm going to work this into something that a person who's getting started with clarinet can play. Right?
Yeah, this is definitely not for a starting clarinet.
Oh, no, 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 no.
This is a lot more challenging.
This is a lot more challenging, for sure. Yeah.
But I would hope that it could inspire a little bit more of that creative side of the brain, just to kind of experience what melodies and harmonies could be like from an alternate perspective.
Yeah. So, and what's funny, when we first set up this podcast, there were these specific pieces we were going to talk about, and I realize I'm avoiding talking about them. I'm saving them for the end. The next one I want to talk about is this impromptu on a D flat. Now, one of the things about this I wanted to ask, well, let's hear a little bit first. Okay. This is solo piano. Just because it's a little bit ahead to this part here. Stopping it, but I just wanted to give some samples. Okay, so one of the technical difficulties there. So one of the things I thought was kind of just amusing was that it's called impromptu on a D flat 7. Okay, so which I liked that title.
Okay.
And it appealed to me. But one of the things that I was thinking is that it's very, again, that you're creating some interesting limitations, because and you tell us at the very beginning, you're telling us, this is what this is going to be about. This is the structure of this piece, you know. And it reminded me a lot of certain Bach preludes that we'll explore, you know, just harmonies. And that can be, and one of the challenges, it also reminded me a little bit of like some of the John Adams, I'm thinking of China Gates, those kind of minimalist pieces that can be, you know, again, challenging to retain interest because you're dealing with, you know, minimal materials. Yet it's so interesting how you vary it, and then this middle section has some very interesting rhythmic structures and in it as well. So anyway, tell me a little bit about what this piece and what your thoughts are.
So this piece is actually a special one for me. It's not my most significant one, but it's what actually got me out of a creative rut that I had for a few years.
Okay.
I was at TMEA, I think 2019 or 2018, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the brief chance to speak with Eric Whitaker.
Okay.
And he gave me some advice on composing, and he said, just try writing something with four notes.
Oh, that's so cool.
Just only four notes.
I love it.
And don't let yourself use anything other than those four notes.
Yes.
And I was so inspired by that. And I thought, well, what can I do with just four?
Yes.
And it encouraged me to explore rhythm, range, inversions, all kinds of things, and this was the culmination of that.
Yeah.
And it made me realize I had a lot more in me than I thought I did.
Isn't that amazing?
All these other pieces came after the impromptu.
This is very important then. That's really amazing. Mm-hmm. So again, that's again a piece of your journey, right? You were in a barrier, you had a barrier period, and you meet someone who you trust, you know, for whatever reason, you know, for their skills and their fame or whatever, but then the challenge sometimes is to say, okay, I have almost too many possibilities. That can be very, paralyzing, right? So you're sort of paralyzed. And then that's so amazing that after this, it's like, that's almost sounds like your second piano concerto by Rachmaninoff. You know, Rachmaninoff was stuck too, and he came up with that second concerto out of his rut. But this piece is so interesting. I didn't know that story, of course, you know, but it's a really, really, really well done in terms of range and in terms of a combination of senses in a way. Very well done. Very well done. Once you started digging in on it, like, you know, you're in a rut, you get this inspiration, you obviously think about it, and then like how long would you say you had to kind of work this to get it to this point, to when it was done?
This piece?
Yeah, this particular piece. Yeah.
I did it in one day, actually.
Dude, really?
Yeah, I just sat down at the computer and I just like went at it.
Oh, I love it. Okay.
Yeah, I was just like weirdly inspired. And I actually have a little collection of four note pieces like that.
I love it. Okay.
There's another one called Dance Miniatures that I haven't put out yet.
Oh, you got to do that because these are really interesting. Yeah.
And it's like sol, la, ti, and do. So it's got that harmonic minor kind of sound to it.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes.
Well, anyway, that's so cool. So that's amazing. So obviously this was like, there was something, you know, that also tells us sometimes what it is that we're stuck, but, and the answer is already in there. Like the answer was in there. This piece was in you, right? It had to be if it came out that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it needed a catalyst of some kind of catalyst. And sometimes what it is we look, I usually say to people, like, frustration should lead to innovation if you want to overcome it, because we tend to be frustrated by doing the same exact thing over and over again. Sometimes we need somebody to wake us up. We try something new, and there it is. So, okay, now we're going to get to the pieces that I actually told you we were going to look at. And let's look at, I thought we might look at, let's do impressions. Now, this one is really yet another contrast in some ways. This is for two pianos, bass, clarinet, and drums. And if I recall, part of the inspiration for this is like heavy metal music, and which I guess the drums play a role in that, right? Am I capturing this right? I don't want to be misrepresenting.
Yeah, a lot of it is in the form and the format, progressive rock and metal particularly.
Okay. I know nothing about this, by the way.
Prague is so great.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a lot of virtuosic performing from all the musicians in the ensemble.
Right.
A lot of mixed time signatures. I'm a huge rhythms person.
I could tell.
I love rhythm. That's my favorite element to play with. Mm-hmm. I get bored with conventional time signatures.
Right, sure.
But yeah, so this is a rhapsody with a lot of different sections. And it plays with, you know, a lot of the themes I also like about Prague, especially albums like larger works, is the thematic elements of storytelling in the narrative and the lyrics. And the note painting and all of that kind of stuff. So this one is actually about the stages of grief after certain event. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of ride out all of the stages with that.
Right, and very involved. I'm going to go into, let's see here. Let's go to, and I was also curious now. Just one second. So I'm a big fan of, you know, I'm a biased fan of piano, and you have two pianos here, and so I was curious what was it about having that much piano you were wanting to, like, what was that choice about?
I just had too many notes that I wanted, and I needed more hands, and that's pretty
that
much
makes
it.
Sense. Okay, I can't think of what I was going to say, but anyway, but that makes a lot of sense. So let's hear a little bit. This is a big work. So what are some other sections you'd like us to showcase a little bit?
Maybe anything from the middle.
Anything from the middle. Okay,
let's go. The end, whole thing just kind of, it's a nonstop ride.
Yeah, right, it is.
Maybe just somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there, let's
try
this part. Okay. Thank you. hate stopping these things. They're so interesting. And if there's anything, do you want me to go to the end? Just to hear the end or?
Whatever you want to listen to.
Let's do that. Okay.
Maybe.
I encourage people to listen to the whole thing. That's the.
Maybe about there.
About there? Okay.
Or further back.
A little further back. Okay.
Yeah, maybe about there.
Sure.
Oh, no, further back.
Further back, okay.
Right there. Okay. I think that'd be good.
Also cool, this is a live performance at your master's recital too,
right?
and the pianist played beautifully, the drummer played beautifully, everybody's played it so well. Was that I think it can be sometimes challenging whenever we're learning a completely new work. How was that, just rehearsing and getting it prepared?
It was actually really scary putting that one together. We only had one rehearsal.
Oh my goodness, are you serious?
One with everybody. That's, yeah.
Wow.
The scheduling was just really hard to get everyone together. For the space, I mean, we had to use the hall.
Right.
And the hall, we could only get it one night.
Oh my gosh.
So we were there like at 11 o'clock at night.
Wow.
Practicing.
These are the stories you don't hear. Like this is the this is real life. Okay.
Yeah. So we all individually put it together, and then we had one day to figure it out. And that was about 2 weeks before the actual performance.
And then even like with the drummer being at a distance, like I was thinking that's ensemble wise, a challenge too. So amazing. This is like the backstage story. Okay.
Yeah.
But it came together really, really well.
I think so.
I really do. I mean, of course I don't know it intimately. I mean, you wrote it, but it certainly conveyed emotion and it was really, really well done. Now there's another piece that I was going to talk about, which was the flute choir, the Reverie. But I also wanted to mention that you're working on, before we do that, you're doing a new version of the Impressions, is that right?
I am. It's a solo with electronics version.
Okay.
Hoping that it's more accessible for performers, because they can just play it alone with
the
a track.
The scheduling problems are reduced.
Problems are eliminated. There's no setup of instruments. Yeah. And it's actually going to be performed at the International Clarinet Association's Clarinet Fest event in Dallas next year.
Oh, that's a
next
big,
summer.
That is a big deal. That's
yeah,
really
so
exciting.
I'm really excited for that.
Yeah.
And it's closer to my original vision for the sound of it. So
okay.
I'm really, really excited for that project. It's almost done.
That's amazing. So is it going to be, are you recreating the two piano and the drum, or is it like different instrumental, like different electric sounds?
So it's just an arrangement. So all the notes are still there. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a different take.
Okay.
On it,
okay.
I guess if I could say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll take a quick listen to a little bit of that in a sec. But
sure.
Let's just go do this. Lastly, a little bit of the clarinet choir. One of the things with clarinet choir, I'm not as it's weird. It's so weird. I have to step back for a second. you know, I have like a life in music myself, and the fact that I have not heard a lot of clarinet choirs is kind of insane.
Yeah.
But it's true. I just haven't heard it. But it's such a great ensemble. It's so rich. I mean, talk about richness of sound. My goodness, it's just quite astounding. So this is, I think we have, yeah, this was done for the UTSA Clarinet Choir. Is that right?
Yeah, it was commissioned by the UTSA Clarinet Choir for a performance at... or their first performance at TMEA this last February.
Okay. So this is a new choir, too.
Yeah, they were just formed 2 years ago.
Like, well, that's why I haven't heard of them before.
When I showed up, that was their first semester existing as an ensemble.
Okay, I feel a little bit better about missing out on this. But yeah.
Yeah, and the thing that's really cool about the clarinet choir as an ensemble is that the range is just huge. Mm-hmm. We have the E flat, which is the higher clarinet, high range, all the B flats. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the alto, the bass, and the contrabass. Mm-hmm. You got the whole range of notes, but also the different textures, the different tonal characters that the instruments have. And one of the things that it's not really a problem, but there's not a whole lot of original repertoire for clarinet choir.
Okay.
They play very frequently arrangements of orchestral music that already exists. And so just trying to make new music out there and throw it out into
that's fantastic because when it's made for that ensemble, you're going to explore like the colors and the timbres, whatever that are present. You're going to be using that as inspiration. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and hear a little bit of this. This is Lost in Reverie, a little bit of the world premiere recording. Kills me to stop that. I wanted to get through into that opening part. They're talking about rhythmic interest. That's like so catchy and it's such an interesting rhythm. But those opening chords just have a great, I don't know, it's some combination of an open sound, as well as just the tones themselves are so rich. It's crazy. It must be amazing. I mean, you're in this performance itself to hear all that around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be amazingly cool.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, really, really cool. But I know later in the piece, I believe it's this particular one, that you actually have people like using their feet and hands to clap. Is it this one or was it?
Oh, that's another one.
That's a different
actually.
One. Okay.
That's another one.
Well, I thought that was so cool. Again, you know, you're like, hey, that's an element we can use, and it was actually, and I also noticed that you, like, everybody has to work, like.
I'm so glad that you noticed that actually, because that is something that I'm intentionally doing with my ensemble music is, and it's probably something that you haven't experienced much as a pianist, but, you know, in the band and orchestra settings, all the more challenging parts are given to the principal chair players,
right? Okay.
And the others are left to the harmonies and the chords.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted everybody to have fun, and so I give solos to every part. Mm-hmm. Everybody works.
Yeah, I was pretty clear because it was actually fun to even watch it because I could see the, you know,
passing around.
Mm-hmm. That was actually just visually also kind of cool. Well, now we're going to get a chance to listen to your one of your newer projects, which is to take impressions, which we heard a little bit of before, and you're doing an electronic version. This is the version that's going to be performed at the International Flute Convention. Is that what it is?
International Clarinet Association.
Clarinet. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That's so crazy. Anyway, so let's take a listen to this.
So this is just the backing track.
Okay.
Line is going to be missing from here because it's meant to be accompaniment.
I see.
So if you can just imagine somebody playing on top of this. This is basically what that is.
And then we're going to start in the middle. And you asked for the middle for a specific reason, I think. What was that?
Yeah, just it shows off some of the more fun, I guess, little wacky hijinks that happen in the middle of it that might be pretty interesting.
Okay, let's check it out. Some fun hijinks coming up here. Let's see. That is going to bring down the house. That is I can't imagine what that's got to be the whole, you know, through the whole thing, but that is so cool. That is going to be amazingly cool. You know, what's fun then is I'm definitely you hear more of the progressive rock element there with all the different instrument and instrumentation. But the hijinks and whatever, I think I'm not sure how many other bass clarinet pieces have this.
I don't know.
Right? I mean, this is going to be like crazy. You're probably going to make some people very upset, and you're going to make 90% of people just like really excited.
I'm fine with that.
I mean, you come on. You, in a way, that's good, making some of those people upset, because then you're really doing something cutting edge. And that is so cool. So are you finding it? I mean, I can tell you must be having fun with this.
Yeah. So this is actually my first time working with electronic. Mm-hmm. With a DAW, you know, and virtual instruments. I mean, I did this in GarageBand for free.
I love it.
I downloaded a plugin.
Everybody starts
for
like
the,
that. Yeah, they all start
you know,
like
but
that.
It's it's been a really fun experience. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm excited about in particular with this piece being performed at ICA's Clarinet Fest is that their theme for next year is all about transcending conventional practices.
That is
and
so perfect.
Just kind of celebrating how the clarinet has been a part of newer history moving forward. So I'm really excited for this one.
This is like this. I'm kind of like this will be amazing. Now, are you going to do a light show or anything like that? Because that would be pretty awesome.
Oh, that's going to be up to the performer.
That would be cool.
I don't know that can be arranged, but I'm wondering if maybe he can have an amp.
That would be
very helpful.
I mean, this is like really going to be. People are going to be talking about this.
I hope so.
Yeah, it's really cool. Well, what would be really cool is before this performance happens, maybe we can have remind me the performer again.
Dr. Counselor.
Maybe we could have a chat with him about what it's like to prepare a piece for electronics and what it's been like to, because he also commissioned, I think, the other some of the things for the clarinet choir, and that would be kind of fun. So maybe we can do that later. But anyway, I highly encourage everybody to check out Clarissa's website. We'll put a description in the description of the website. She has her scores there. You can purchase scores there. You can also hear a lot of her repertoire. And wow, it's just been such fun to talk to you today.
Thank you. Yeah.
Really, I appreciate you sharing this with us. And I'm just really excited for all the things you have going on.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us as well. We'll see you next time.